From Radio 720 WGN Chicago, it's time for Extension 720. Here's your host, Milt Rosenberg.
Over the last 20 years, I should think, a new discipline has arisen. The questions it asks were around earlier, but now medical ethics and bioethics has become indeed a professional specialty. Three people who are engaged in bioethical discourse and investigation are my guests tonight. Two of them, John Kilner and Nigel Cameron, are in fact important people at the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity, which was established about 4 or 5 years ago and is located out in the suburbs in Bannockburn, Illinois. Leon Cass is our other guest. He is a physician by training as well as a professor at the Committee on Social Thought at the University of Chicago, and a man who's written a great deal on bioethical issues, as have John Kilner and Nigel Cameron. Gentlemen, I was thinking, do you like this as an epigraph for our discussion? I won't tell you who said it. Maybe you could tell me. As to the exposure and rearing of children, let there be a law that no deformed child shall live. Who do you think said that? Adolf Hitler? It was Aristotle. It's Aristotle in the Politics. And I can't resist. Allow me one more quick quotation. Here's his student Plato from the Republic itself. This is the sort of medicine and this is the sort of law which you will sanction in your state. They will minister to better natures, giving health both of soul and of body. But those who are diseased in their bodies, they will leave to die. And the corrupt and incurable soul, they will put an end to themselves. That is clearly the best thing for the patients and for the state. I think I've provoked you enough. What's your reaction, Nigel Cameron?
Well, I think my primary reaction is, of course, that these are ancient questions.
Mm-hmm.
And it is interesting that the Judeo-Christian tradition, with its sort of Hippocratic medical framework, essentially drove those convictions from the field for many hundreds of years of the Western tradition. And now, at this time of unparalleled progress in medicine and science and wealth in our communities, all of a sudden those perspectives are coming back to haunt us. And I think that is a very interesting reflection.
Particularly with regard to the aged.
Particularly so, in that this is not a good time to be aging. There have been much better times in the history of the West, even when medicine was a lot less powerful than this today.
Because now with sort of social medicine or the social provision of health care, it costs so damn much to keep older people alive. Didn't I see a figure someplace that the last year of life takes about as much medical cost for maintenance as the prior 10 or 12 years?
Yes, there are those statistics that are out. Of course, the difficulty is identifying in advance when it is the last year of life. This is something that doesn't correlate neatly with mm-hmm. age, and so neat criteria to start excluding people at a certain age from health care are very, very problematic.
Yeah, one of the things that's really quite worrisome in the current so-called death with dignity movement is that there's a very dangerous alliance between some people who feel that medicine has in fact gone too far and they simply want to be reassured that they will not be degraded and dehumanized by excess treatment, and other people who want to cut down the costs and are only too eager to get the elderly and the infirm out of the way to cut expenses. The pressures to find a quick technical solution, both for high economic costs and for length of life, are mounting.
Interesting things are happening in the different countries. I learned from reading the bulletin of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity that in the Netherlands they've now put through a euthanasia law, which makes it a very easy thing to do. In fact, it even makes it possible to murder people, in that you don't need the consent of children if you decide that they should die.
Well, it's up for consideration now. In fact,
it hasn't finally and fully been passed.
That's right, exactly. Of course, for many years now, the courts have decided not to prosecute under certain conditions.
When parents and doctors decide to kill the child.
Well, this is a new twist in terms of extending this all the way down to children. It's more been on the adult level previously. And the child provision is very controversial. It may or may not go through, but formal legalization of the practice would be a new development.
But in this country, as you well know, this is ganz amerikanisch, this is the American way to do it. Mm-hmm. We take the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and we add to it the right to die.
Well, that's a euphemism, really, the right to die.
It's used a good deal.
It's certainly used a good deal. And it should be disentangled. I mean, there are some people who mean by it really the right to die with dignity. And I don't think anybody can be in principle opposed to that. The issue comes when, what do you mean by dignity? Do you mean dignity to take some kind of rapid lethal injection, or you mean the right to die in the company of your friends and to be cared for without excessive intrusive technical intervention? We have not yet established a right to die. The Supreme Court, bless it, given the opportunity to find in the Constitution a so-called right to die, refused to do so, and said the Constitution didn't license such a notion. Though something like this has, as you know, been opened up in the state of Oregon by voter referendum, where assisted suicide is at least been legalized. It's not quite the same thing as a right to die, but it's on the road.
This is only one of many issues in the broad realm of bioethics that we need to discuss tonight. Mm-hmm. But I started with it, I suppose, because it's the most traumatic. And isn't it incredible that we've gone this far, 10 minutes into the conversation, and the name of Dr. Kevorkian has not yet come up?
Well, this is partly because Dr. Kevorkian is where he deserves to be, which is behind bars, and he's he's been less on the front pages of the news magazines than he used to be.
But he cut an interesting career for the 10 years before he went to prison.
I think so. We ran a conference some years ago, and my proposal was that we advertise this with a picture of Jack Kevorkian. Of course, it's this memorable sepulchral face, mm-hmm. which he has. who could cartoon a pathologist better? In which, you know, we asked the question, is this the face of the future? And it may well be that his meteoric career has helped clarify some of these questions and to show a lot of people that this is not the future that they want.
Well, clarified it with, there's one case in particular that it seemed to me raised some crucial issues. One of his patients whom he assisted to death was a youngish fellow, only in his 50s, as I remember, and he had some sort of disease, but it wasn't a fatal one. But he was very depressed, and he just, quote, didn't want to live anymore. And Kevorkian said, are you sure you don't want to live? And he said, I don't want to live. And so really, on the basis of depression, as much as any other disease, Kevorkian helped him kill himself.
Well, I think this does focus very sharply. I mean, the fact that Kevorkian basically is a serial killer, in traditional sort of jurisprudence terms. But I mean, he has focused this issue the way that in the Netherlands now we have this widespread euthanasia jurisdiction, even though it's only semi-legal, public policy there favors it. And in Oregon now, because we have the first foothold in the states, essentially the practical problem here for those who value human dignity truly, whatever their ideological perspective, is how you really ascertain who really wants to die. I mean, what is informed consent in a situation in which typically people are scared and depressed, because these are attendant conditions of serious illness, chronic illness, terminal illness.
Well, this is one of the great illusions, isn't it, about this whole debate, and that is that a standard of informed consent can protect us. I mean, that's one of the main provisions of the Oregon situation, that we will only apply this to people where their informed consent is given. But of course, the studies have been done of the practice in the Netherlands, and the first government study that was carried out documented 6,000 cases where people's lives were ended without their consent, even though that was the hallmark protection. So it just goes to show that once you cross the line and say life is up for grabs, we assess it as to whether it's worth saving or worth ending. Even standards like informed consent are...
All three of you here are of philosophical, and at least two of you, theological bent as you go at these issues. Leon Kass is that, and also he's a physician. From the point of view of medicine, is there some sort of consensual agreement that physicians, modern physicians, come to with regard to what the real purpose of medicine is? Is it to alleviate suffering? Is it to put off death? Neither or both of the above?
Well, I think it's simply honest to say that modern medicine has no agreement on this question. The old timers, I think, say that their task is to heal when possible, and where healing is not possible, to care and give comfort always. Current arguments say, look, the relief of suffering, especially toward the end of life, takes priority. even to the point many of the younger physicians will say you should relieve suffering by eliminating the sufferer. That's that in a way, life with suffering is worse than no life at all. And one hears these arguments.
A lesser issue is should you alleviate suffering by lying?
By lying?
Yeah. To the patient about the state.
Well, you mean in connection with this death and dying, or more generally?
Well, lying about the state of his health and what his prospects are.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is one of this, because to come back to the question of informed consent, every expert knows how easy it is to shape a patient's decision just by how you present the prognosis, what you treat the alternatives to be, how you simply speak about these things. And you can pretty much get people to choose the way you want or to manipulate their ambivalences the way you want. I was a witness for the state in one of the first Kevorkian trials. I was brought in as an expert on medical ethics, and I won't bother you about many of the details. But I had a chance to witness, two things. One, I witnessed the film with one of his first patients, Janet Atkins, who had multiple sclerosis very early. And I saw the film of how this man talked to this woman and how he asked leading questions until she said, "What is it you want to do? What is it you want to do? I guess I want to die." End of conversation. No checking up on it. Nothing like that. And you saw how easy you take advantage of someone's anxieties, their depression, their ambivalences about life. And you paint the picture in a certain way. It's not exactly lying, but it's a form of manipulation and very subtle coercion. And what looks like a movement for patient autonomy is going to be, in many instances, a movement for expert intervention and decision, often on the basis not of the patient's best interests. I think that's a very worrisome thing.
Fascinating report from that. Somehow I can't help but say that it reminds me of the way in which psychotherapists sometimes structure the decisions of their patients.
No, indeed.
I think that this does draw attention to one of the central problems in contemporary bioethics, and that is the way in which informed consent has been, it's a sort of genie come out of the bottle here, to take the place of some kind of consensus set of standards according to which medicine is practiced. The whole thing is privatized, and you know, it's your medical ethics. You know, what do you want? It's your health. I mean, the whole thing revolves upon you. And this requires it to be possible to determine what, in fact, you think. Now, most people don't think about these things. Most people want to do what the doctor wants. Most people spend, you know, maybe a lot of time and energy trying to find out what it is the doctor really would recommend. You know, what would you do if it was your son, your daughter, you know, what would yourself? And the sort of mythical character of the informed consent process and its lack of connection with any substantive commitments on the part of most patients. I mean, there are exceptions. I mean, I'm sure Dr. Cass, when he is a patient, engages in some serious informed consent activity, you know, but the typical patient does not. And yet we talk of informed consent. Informed consent is now the sort of fulcrum on which the whole moral justification for medical care rests. Otherwise, it's simply assault, because we've lost the notion of shared values and the professional practice of medicine within that consensus. And therefore, the issue of euthanasia here, which is, you know, the flashpoint of this conversation, in fact takes us into a much broader reflection on contemporary bioethics. And the fact that it has to rely upon informed consent because it's departed from the notion that there is any consensus, or indeed that one should be sought, that we should be seeking to build consensus.
That, of course, raises instantly the question of how you get consent from embryos. And that relates to a number of issues, some of which have agitated the nation, some of which so far are only agitating bioethicists. We'll turn to some of those issues, if you are willing, right after we pause for these words.
Get it first.
There will be no agreement if the Israelis are not satisfied on the nature of the peace.
Get it fast.
Don't ask, don't tell doesn't make sense.
WGN Radio News.
Russian officers say there's been heavy shelling of suspected rebel positions.
We got a record number of children to teach and a shortage of qualified teachers.
Once he's back in Cuba in a totalitarian communist country, he's never coming back.
Chicago's News.
Of course, once that happens, the subpoena won't amount to much.
Radio 720.
Are you better off than you were 7 years ago?
WGN.
This summer, Marshall Field's Travel Service has planned the ultimate millennium experience. It's a touch of 20th century elegance mixed with elements of history and mystery and a dash of 21st century sophistication. Marshall Field's Travel Service has put together an unforgettable visit to Great Britain, highlighted by a QE2 voyage, a ride on the Orient Express, and a Concorde flight. Your trip begins with a six-day transatlantic crossing aboard Cunard's legendary QE2, luxury and timeless elegance on the world's most famous ship. Docking in Southampton, you'll take a day trip to London on the Orient Express. Then you'll stay two nights at the five-star Ritz Hotel overlooking Green Park and Piccadilly before returning to America on the supersonic Concorde. Many meals and sightseeing are included. Departures are on June 19th and September 4th only. The price for this trip of a lifetime starts as low as $6,995. For details, call 1-800-726-8699. Hurry, availability is limited. Restrictions apply. The QE2 is registered in Great Britain. Call Marshall Field's Travel Service today at 1-800-726-8699.
If you're like most people, you've made some brave resolutions for the new year.
I'm going to watch less sports on TV.
I'm going to lose 10 pounds. I'm going to lose 10 pounds. I'm going to lose 10 pounds after this cookie.
Yep, we've heard them all before. But why not start your new year off on the right track by making one resolution you can keep?
No more driving downtown. They're going to see a brand new me at the office, on time, refreshed, and ready to go every day.
Now that'll be easy to keep. Just take Metra, the commuter rail system. With winter here, it's a perfect time to start. Sleet, snow, and icy roads mean miserable driving, never being sure you're going to get there when you want to get there. So instead of making a resolution like this,
I'm going to do 100 sit-ups every morning before breakfast.
Resolve to take Metra. You'll really like our quick, dependable service, convenient schedules, and our money-saving ticket options. And you won't have to drive through another glorious Chicago winter. Just call 836-7000, city or suburbs, for Metra schedule information. That's 836-7000.
Oh, honey, I think my back went out.
Have you heard the news? The Cubby Bear's opened a third location. The Cubby Bear North, located in Lincolnshire on Milwaukee Avenue between Route 22 and Deerfield Road. Featuring the same great music, sporting events, and food that you've come to expect from the Cubby Bear Wrigleyville. Come try the all-you-care-to-eat Sunday brunch. Catch all the NFL playoff action on two big screens and 31 monitors. The Cubby Bear North in Lincolnshire on Milwaukee Avenue between Route 22 and Deerfield Road. For reservations, call 847-541-4700. 847-541-4700.
When the outside temperature drops below 20 degrees, water pipes in homes with little or no insulation can freeze and break. State Farm Insurance wants to help you avoid damage to your home and possessions caused by frozen pipes. Be sure to insulate pipes that are most likely to freeze in cold weather, those in outer walls and attics or in crawl spaces. Let your faucets trickle overnight in sinks located in outside walls and leave cabinet doors open under those sinks. If you're going away for an extended period of time, maintain adequate heat in your home by setting the thermostat no lower than 55 degrees. This message brought to you by the good neighbors at State Farm Insurance.
We now return to Extension 720 from WGN Radio Chicago. This is Milton Rosenberg.
With a quick reintroduction of our guests, and then on to yet other realms of bioethical concern. Nigel Cameron is the chair of the advisory board for the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity. He's also the former provost of Trinity International University. John Kilner is the director of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity, and he is professor of bioethics and contemporary culture at Trinity International University in Deerfield, Illinois. Leon Cass is professor in the college and in the Committee on Social Thought at the University of Chicago. He's a founding fellow and a board member of the Hastings Center, which is an institute for the study of ethics in relation to the life sciences. And he is as well an MD as well as a PhD. And gentlemen, two of you at least are serious Christians, namely John Kilner and Nigel Cameron. Leon Cass probably has many friends who are Christians. Even I have friends who are Christians. But I want to get to a basic difference between us. I am a secularist. If I were religious, I'd be Judaic. I mean, I've got Judaic roots, and they matter to me. Mm-hmm. But I am quite bothered by and quite opposed to abortion, and I think I always have been during my conscious years, and particularly as the abortion movement got going. Mm-hmm. I come to it somehow from a ground other than biblical and other than Christian. Yet you suppose you lost your faith tomorrow, Nigel, would you still be against abortion?
ask me tomorrow. Sure. I mean, in fact, the rationale, my understanding of the Christian rationale, Judeo-Christian rationale, for a position that opposes abortion, I think essentially is entirely in harmony with the secular argument here, in the specifically religious dimension that we believe man is made in the image of God, and that we believe that our Lord Jesus Christ was incarnate in embryo. I mean, there are specific doctrinal questions here. All these do is illustrate for those who are Christians or who are Jews, something which is really rather evident to everybody who watches PBS, which is that there's a fundamental biological continuity in human being, as in all mammalian development, from the word go and the fertilization through to the grave. I mean, and that you cannot have any. I mean that human dignity is invisible, is perhaps one way of putting this. And I would certainly be as convinced of the indivisibility of human dignity, and therefore of the need to oppose abortion as part of any kind of human rights understanding of the framework for our dealings in the public square, as I would be of my special religious convictions. And if the one fell, the other would, I believe, surely stand.
Would you then say to any physicians who actively practice abortion that they are engaged in immoral activity?
I'm not the sort of fellow that points fingers easily, and I don't like doing it. But I think I would say that a physician who understood to the bottom what it means to be a healer would regard the active taking of a life, whether in utero or toward the end of days, as somehow a contradiction of the medical vocation. The Hippocratic Oath put it this way. I mean, I will not give to a patient a deadly drug, even if asked for it. I will not give to a woman an abortive remedy. In purity and holiness, I will guide my art, my life and my art. And that's not based on Judeo-Christian morals, but based upon a certain kind of medical insight of what it is to be a healer of the living human body. I find it just perplexing how a person could, in the practice of gynecology and obstetrics, have two patients in adjoining rooms, exactly in the same condition. In one case, he rushes in to help shore up a pregnancy that's in trouble, same stage of life. Next room, rushes in to do a D&C and bring that life to conclusion. I don't know what that person's understanding of the healing vocation is, that they can live with that kind of dichotomy.
Well, what he would say to you, if you pressed him on it, if he were here tonight, what he would say is, well, you're assuming my obligation is to this unborn embryo or this unborn fetus, which may or may not be life, but I've got a larger obligation to my patient, who is the woman who is carrying that fetus. No. And if her mental health or her circumstances require that she be rid of that fetus, I'm rendering proper service to her.
No, I understand that there's the trouble in all these reproductive matters is that there's more than one patient.
Yeah.
And there is a burgeoning field of fetal medicine that's rushing in there on the premise that what you have in there is something. I won't insist that it is a full human being. That's a discussable matter, but that it's not nothing. It's worthy of respect. It's not to be treated lightly, and that on its way to life, we nurture it and protect it, except perhaps under the most limited restricted of circumstances.
Well, I fully agree, as I've said before. But if I can ask you to turn to such sociological, how do you account for the fact that, not merely in this country, but in all of the Western world at least, abortion has become absolutely a nonchalant undertaking, virtually? I doubt we can ever get that genie back into the bottle.
Well, it's because there are other dynamics at issue here. I mean, when you have two lives in conflict, or you have the life of the fetus in conflict with the interests of society, you have the interests of the woman or others who are involved in the decision-making in that situation. It could be the man and the woman. Or it could be society at large. And so the question is, when you have a conflict between their interests and the interests of this weak one with no voice, it's no surprise as to who would win out there. And so the question becomes, should this young weak one be given a voice? And if not, why not? And it seems that the science is self-evident in one direction. So what are the arguments to exclude this week one from having a voice.
Yeah, I don't, by the way, Milt, think that this practice is simply nonchalant. I mean, we might have become inured to it, and we justify it, and there are all kinds of people who, because we don't want to pronounce judgments on other people's practice, are unwilling to, the majority, at least for the time being, are unwilling to reverse Roe v. Wade legislatively or in some other way. But the vast majority of Americans, 75%, still think there's something wrong with this. And people don't do it lightly, and the people who do it agonize over it, and that there's at least some kind of recognition that a grave violation is taking place, not only to the nascent life that's being destroyed, but I think most women who experience this feel that there's in some way a violation of their own generative capacities.
Mm-hmm. I think, of course, your use of the term nonchalant is provocative, and it is provoked. And that I explained to the case that there is a deep-seated intuitive unease here. I mean, I certainly know physicians who do many abortions, and they don't like it. I'm sure there are some who are completely inured, but many of those who do it don't like it at all. Many people get out of the trade, they get out of nursing and so on to avoid having to get involved with it, even if they aren't in principle opposed. In much of Europe, I mean, there are curious legal restrictions on abortion. In the sort of very liberal countries of Scandinavia, I mean, there are all sorts of restrictions in terms of waiting periods and counseling requirements and so on. In Germany, after the first 12 weeks, it gets quite complex. I mean, it's interesting that there's a lot of ambivalence there. In the American context, these things have been swept away, partly because of the way that the law works. But the other thing, let me just tell you a story. I mean, because abortion isn't a new issue. And one of my childhood memories, I was very close to my grandmother, who died when I was 11 or 12. I was her sort of favorite grandson when I was a boy. And she used to drink, not a great deal, but enough, so that she would say things to her grandson which really she shouldn't. And she shared with me, and I remembered this about 15 years after the event, because I knew what it meant, that she had an abortion. In that she had, you know, had three daughters, my mother and her sisters, and her husband had put under pressure to have a boy. He wanted a boy, a son, an heir, and so on. In the end, that they split up. And she'd had an abortion and was sure that this had been the boy. And this thing had troubled her, you know, for 30 years. And she shared it when she'd been drinking with her infant grandson because it so troubled her. And I think we don't have to take the view that there is some kind of deep-seated, recognizable post-abortion syndrome, as some have argued. I mean, that may or may not be the case. But the notion that you really can erase the kind of moral intuitions which recognize the special protection the mother should afford the fetus, you can go a certain way to doing that by changing social mores, changing law, changing practice, as we have done here. At the end of the day, people I know have had abortions, admitted in secret, in private, and share their grief, by and large, in that this is still a taking not simply of the life of one of us, but of course of one of us who is wholly dependent upon us for his or her protection. And that is something the practice may carry on as it is now, I don't know, but I think that the moral intuition will never be quite erased. On the other hand, I mean, you know, look at slavery as an institution in this country, in Europe and in different parts of the world for long periods. Look at apartheid and its appalling consequences in Southern Africa. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at many of these things, which many people just came to terms with and thought were normal. And we look back on them and we wave our hands in horror.
They are doing yet other things to pre-birth humans in utero, which are very troubling. And I know that the people who gather together at the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity are concerned with those matters. What are some of them that are high on your agenda?
Yes, well, we've been addressing human cloning and also stem cell research. I think that stem cell research has been in the news a lot recently, and the greatest confusion there is the fact that there are, broadly grouped, two different types of stem cell research, one in which you take stem cells, which are cells that have not differentiated to focus on a certain part of the body.
They're cells that can become anything.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's one set that come from adult human beings, and we're doing a lot of research and learning how we can take those kinds of cells and develop them into, I mean, the hope is to be able to develop them into new organs, new tissues, blood, very, you know, brain cells.
So that somebody with an injured heart after a few major heart attacks might have some cardiac tissue generated from stem cell tissue grafted onto him in a way that would be curative or restorative.
Oh, exactly. The potential here is tremendous. And so to and to have people donating those cells so that they can be developed in these directions is tremendous. However, there's another source for stem cells, and that is to take a human embryo and actually to cut it up into its component cells, which then are allowed to grow. And
that would be an embryo that has been aborted. That would be an aborted fetus.
Well, or specially created for this purpose.
Specially created? How?
Yes. Well, specially created by practice of in vitro fertilization. When couples now when infertile couples go to the assisted reproduction clinic, egg and sperm are taken, mixed together in the laboratory. Some of those are fertilized and develop into several cell embryos and are put back into the woman for pregnancy. Lots of the other embryos are just frozen and kept around, and a certain euphemism has developed. These are called now spare embryos, and the question is, whose are they and what should be done with them? Wouldn't it be wasteful, say some scientists, to just discard them when we could in fact use them, grow them up a little bit and take the cells and use
grow them up still in an extrauterine environment.
In an extrauterine environment, and then extract the stem cells from them and do the same sorts of things.
Has that been done, actually?
Yes.
Or has it just been contemplated?
No, no, this has been done. This has been done. Embryos have been cultivated to blastocyst stage, and cells have been taken out and grown in culture. And there are restrictions at the moment for the use of government funds for this research, but there is quite a lot of it going on in the private sector where no such restrictions apply. This is really part of a whole burgeoning area of manipulation of embryos, of which stem cell research is really just a small part.
You are quoted someplace, as I discovered in my recent reading, Leon, as saying, indeed here it is, if we come to see ourselves as meat, then meat we shall become.
Well, that refers to a whole range of biomedical technologies that are coming at us fast and furious, that have as their true meaning nothing short of the redesigning of human nature, beginning with the attempt to cure disease, but looking ahead to the enhancement of this potential through genetic enhancement or possibly putting in computer chips in the brain, beginning with curing blindness with a retinal implant, but then going on to all kinds of other things. And the real question here is, one can understand the motives of people trying to, certainly to heal disease.
Stevie Wonder is looking forward to that implant. I read that just recently.
Indeed. And no one can oppose these things. But it's perfectly clear that the things that are introduced for therapeutic purposes are available for eugenic purposes or for any attempt to redesign the human being as somebody wishes.
Well, Leon, give us a bit of a primer on this, just in terms of what's been happening in research. How far, in fact, have we gone in the development of replacement parts and the development of genetic manipulations so as to alter the very structure of the human being?
Well, I mean, let's start with the thing which has been a lot in the news and which is likely to be in the news again frequently, and that is the area of cloning. Cloning is a technique of bypassing the lottery of sexual reproduction and to produce individuals that are genetically almost identical, virtually identical to already existing adults. This began with the sheep dolly. It's been successfully developed in cows and in mice, and the success rate now has become very, very high. And there's been a lot of talk, and there's a great deal of public revulsion about this, but what this really means, and what is really novel about this, is now parents would not be saying yes to the desire to have a child, but they would be able to determine exactly what kind of a child they now are going to have, and in this case, to choose the complete genetic makeup of a child after the existence of an adult who they want to copy. That's a transformation of individual identity that begins to transform procreation into manufacture, and it is a form of despotism of parents over their children. We begin down this road in which you start by saying every child a wanted child, and once the technologies arrive, should they arrive, the only child that anybody is going to care for are the ones that they've actually wanted and designed.
How does this work? A young couple are contemplating their first child, and they say to one another, let's make him as much like Bill Clinton as possible. So he has Bill Clinton's good looks, Bill Clinton's sense of morality and dignity.
I bite my tongue.
So how do you go about that?
How does one...
Do you get some epithelial cells from Bill Clinton?
Any cells will do.
Yeah.
You grow cells in tissue culture. They're an unlimited number. You can even cultivate cells from people that have died, and therefore you can clone a deceased ancestor. What you do is you take the egg of the woman, you remove the nucleus that's in there, you put in the nucleus, which contains the genetic material from this adult, from the cells from the adult. The embryo then develops as if it were fertilized. You put it back into the woman, the child that grows up will be virtually a genetic copy of that person, Michael Jordan, Bill Clinton,
Madonna.
But wait, it has the haploid number of chromosomes.
No. It has the right number because it's taken from a mature cell, from a body cell of the adult.
Rather than a reproductive cell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Isn't it fair to say that what's terribly intriguing about this isn't just the notion that you could copy the genetic code of a currently existing human being? I mean, there are certain beings that people that we're fascinated with. But I think whether it's ourselves or somebody else in our most honest moments, of course, we would admit that, well, if we could change a few things, I mean, this would be much more attractive. And I think that this represents a first very rough step toward a much larger enterprise, and that is to actually shape the complete genetic code of the child we want to have, not simply to mirror a currently existing human being, but actually to design that person to order.
And how does the completion of the genome project bear upon these prospects?
Well, of course, I mean, this is where these two things come together, because cloning essentially offers a kind of dry run for what will become possible when the implications of the Human Genome Project really begin to flow thick and fast into the sort of manufacturing possibilities for intervention in the reproductive process. I mean, presently, once human cloning comes of age, as it will, some of us think, really quite shortly, we will have the first opportunities. You know, if a young couple, they want to have a child, they will get onto the internet, fire up the computer, and, you know, pick what they want.
Some commercials are overdue. This is too fascinating a conversation. I'm running late. But let me plant a consideration. The fellow climbed the Matterhorn because it was there. One rule generally in technology is if anything can be done, it will be done. Isn't there a smack of inevitability about these prospects, even though they are very disturbing? And what kind of ethical analysis does one bring to these prospects in a way that could be persuasive that we ought to put aside our Promethean aspirations? We return directly to Leon Cass, to John Kilner, and to Nigel Cameron after these words.
What's the deal on Wall Street?
Stocks are taking a beating.
What are they saying at the Board of Trade?
I think this is going to be the beginning of a very volatile year.
How will the Fed react?
Technology stocks are among those getting hit hard.
We know you need answers.
Is this an adjustment? Is this a crash?
That's why we give you the business.
Crash.
Around the clock.
Crash.
The world isn't ending?
No.
The Dow average has been higher.
Chicago's new ask on Radio 720 WGN.
How do you earn a 5-star safety rating? With over 40 standard safety features. That's Ford Windstar, the only minivan to earn the government's 5-star safety rating for both front and side impact. Plus, Windstar features an available rear sensing system and dual-powered sliding doors. Right now, the 2000 Windstar LX comes with 3.9 financing or $1,500 cash back. Like what you hear? Stay tuned.
More than 3.5 million people trust Ford Taurus to get them to 3.5 million different places in 5-star safety. And who could be surprised? Ford Taurus is a hardworking car for hardworking Americans. And right now, get 0.9 financing and $1,500 cash back on every 99 Taurus. Sounds good? Keep listening.
Since you like what you hear, visit your Ford store for complete details.
Not all customers will qualify for lowest APR through Ford Credit. Cash back direct from Ford. You must take new retail delivery from dealer stock on these limited time offers. Visit your local Ford store today.
Andrew Hochberg wants to represent you in Congress. But what do we really know about him? Well, Andy and his wife, Lori, both grew up in the 10th District. Andy in Glencoe, Lori in nearby Glenview. And it's right there where they're raising their three children. Lori is a pediatrician. She practices in Vernon Hills in Highland Park. Andy is a founder and former president of CityPAC. Andy graduated from New Trier, the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School of Business, and earned his law degree from Northwestern University. As the former CEO of Wheeling-based Sportmart, Andy knows what it means to pay the bills and meet a payroll.
Hello, I'm Andy Hochberg. As your Republican representative in Congress, I'll work hard to provide our children with safe schools, find a way to ease the growing traffic in our community, and make sure that you, not the government, make the important decisions in your life.
That's why this message is authorized and paid for by the friends and neighbors who make up the Andrew Hochberg for Congress Committee.
From Radio 720 WGN, this is Extension 720. Here's your host and moderator, Milt Rosenberg.
And we return to conversation with John Kilner, who is the director of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity out in Bannockburn, Illinois, and Nigel Cameron, who is a member of the advisory board of the center and is the former provost of Trinity International University, where John Kilner remains a professor of bioethics and contemporary culture. And Leon Cass has joined us. He is a distinguished member of the University of Chicago faculty, where he is a professor in the Committee on Social Thought. And the question I was raising is essentially, these processes aren't stoppable, are they? There's kind of an inexorable move forward, or maybe downward, but these things are going to happen, are they not?
Well, certainly these technologies will move forward to some degree unless there is a proactive in advance recognition of the evils of them, of the wrongness of them, or if not of the technologies as a whole, of certain uses of them. And this is the challenge. I think once they are done and once they are out and being used, it is hugely difficult to regulate, to haul them back in. But the problem is we don't tend to do serious wrestling with the issues and to form guidelines and legislation until after the fact.
Then let's go back to the issue before the fact, or somewhat before the fact. Leon Cass, what's wrong with that nice couple deciding that they want their first child to be essentially a duplicate
of
Uncle Charles rather than Bill Clinton?
I'm not sure that the arguments will do justice to and make absolutely clear what the intuition is. In fact, I've written an argument called an article called The Wisdom of Repugnance, in which I think that people's initial revulsion to this thought is in a way the bearer of a kind of deep wisdom, and I'm not sure that we can make an adequate argument that would explain that. But I tried to say before, what are you really doing to the child? What is the relation between the parent and the child when you undertake not only to give that child life, but to decide exactly what kind of qualities that child should have? That's not somehow saying yes to new life in its spontaneity and variety and indeterminacy. That's to lay a certain kind of blueprint on that child. And the child, even though it will be a human being, will be, in the decisive respect, an artifact of the parents' wishes and a creature of their will. Seems to me it's a misunderstanding of parenthood, which I suppose in a free country everybody's free to misunderstand in the way that they wish.
Of course, that assumes that the nature of the child as he or she grows will have been just about fully determined by the genetic composition,
yep,
rather than by intrauterine environment and then experiential environment within the family.
I know all those arguments, and environment will play a part, but unless one thought that the genetic likeness would be so powerful, there would be no reason to clone Uncle Charlie or Michael Jordan in the first place. I mean, I've never heard so many arguments in favor of environmental influences until this cloning discussion got started. They're disingenuous. People would clone because they want duplicates.
I mean, the irony is that if, let us say, somebody were cloned, but they and those around them were entirely unaware of the fact that they were cloned and the parents weren't telling, you'd have a completely different situation from the one in which you would have in which knowledge was out there. And that essentially the environment conspires to give significance to the biological question. In that it is, when the child's first discovery of self-consciousness and so on leads him or her to recognize that, that he or she is a clone of the brother or sister who died or of Uncle Charles or whoever it is, the full horror of the sort of compromised character of his or her human personhood becomes evident to the child, him or herself. So, I mean, it's in a sense, I mean, the heredity and the environmental questions come absolutely together here. And one would want to make a claim that, what convoluted thought in this little sentence, but that every child has a right not to be born a clone. I mean, that is to say that this is a fundamental assault on our notion of what it means to be human, to be the creature of the planning of another.
You know, that breaks the mind somehow, the androids and humanoids or whatever they are in all the science fiction things, particularly that great science fiction series, what was it called, you know, with Captain...
Star Trek?
Star Trek, of course. Data, is that his name? The android, the robot? Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes, and of course the current movie, Bicentennial Man, that's out right now, same theme.
I haven't seen that, yeah. But there is the question, did they have the right to create that full and even sensitive being, but to their own specifications rather than to, of course, that's not a biological being.
Yes, but I think one very interesting situation here, whether we look at it from that angle or from the angle of cloning, and that is, you know, if you asked people, would they like to have a clone, you get one kind of response, oh, this could be kind of intriguing, kind of interesting. Would you like to be a clone? You'd almost get a dramatically opposite response.
Sure.
And I think that what that reveals is that we recognize deep down that the notion of being brought into existence to suit the purposes of another or society, or even if it's one's parents, is a fundamentally difficult situation.
Many years ago, a great British novelist, in 1935, I think, Aldous Huxley, published a dystopian novel titled Brave New World. It begins with the Bokunovsky process, as it's called, which generates not single clones, but cloned groups, duplicates of alphas, gammas, and deltas, or
all of them, gamma epsilons, right?
All the way down.
Yeah.
And he then borrows from Pavlov and shows you how you train the alphas and all the other groups to their own special qualities. Is it conceivable that you could have multiple clones generated really for to be the viewers of water and so on, viewers of wood and the drawers of water?
Well, of course, the two issues here. One is that of the jurisdiction in which one is speaking, and there are certain jurisdictions in the world in which all kinds of classes of person are used for that purpose, whether on racial or tribal or political grounds. And in those contexts, whether we're talking about Saddam Hussein's Iraq or whatever the bête noire happens to be, the notion that there is no jurisdiction where that is how technology might well be used plainly is fatuous. I mean, this is political reality. Technology is used for purposes of power. But secondly, we have a timeline question. Now, I think it isn't at all implausible. I mean, I was seeing that one of Wilnut's colleagues from my home country of Scotland, of course, where this technology of cloning was developed, like so many great medical advances and disadvances were. One of his colleagues is now in New Zealand seeking to raise a herd of 1,500 cloned cattle, who I presume are all meant to be identical. And this is the purpose of the project. Now, it seems to me...
We call five... Quintuplets and six.
We're going to have to get back into our Latin to find out. It seems to me not at all implausible that within 10 years we will have cohorts of cloned Clintons or Madonnas or, you know, whoever the heroes happen to be, and of course the religious heroes will end up on this lineup as well as the secular.
No brave new world that hath such clones in it. You see.
And we will have cohorts, and what would it be to be born as one of 1,500, you know, or one of 5,000? Essentially monozygotic twins.
Yeah, I'm doubtful about that, Nigel, really. I one can't rule it out that there will be mass-scale cloning.
This is the National Enquirer Society. This is a tabloid culture in which we're living. You and I aren't going to do this. I mean, our secular liberal friends aren't going to do this, but these aren't the people who make up the market.
Well, the ultimate question is there money in it? Might you generate a very cheap workforce that way?
Mm-hmm. That's the utilitarian. I mean, if we can achieve benefits for it, for society or for people at large. I mean, that's the driving force, and that's the danger in many of these issues. I mean, whether it's the stem cell research or anything else, once you can point out that something will be economically beneficial or have a great health benefit, then no matter what it takes to do
it. You can alter the social rule. I offered a month ago. If it can be done, it will be done. If you can make money from it, it will be done.
Yeah. Well, I think we have begun to see how the commercial interests are already at work and are going to drive this process. The biotech firms are all ready and waiting and working on the material coming from the human genome.
And they have a major role in preventing legislation.
And they have done that already. But you also see advertisements in the newspapers on the elite college campuses advertising for egg donors of a certain height, a certain SAT score,
and ethnicity.
And ethnicity, and they're paying up to $50,000 for a young woman to come forward and donate eggs for somebody else. Now, And there was, whether it was a hoax or not, there was an advertisement of people selling their eggs on the internet.
I remember.
Right.
So once
the commercial interests get going, I don't think you need tyrannical governments. What you need is free choice, some technological entrepreneurs and business. And we could go a long way in the direction of Brave New World simply by free choice and the technological imperative.
It is clear that the three of you are agreed there are biological profanations possible. One of them conducted now, many more to come. The question that must be raised, and I raise it now, even as we pause yet once again, is Lenin's great question. What is to be done? And I will ask you to address that right after we pause for these words.
Winter weather is torture on my skin. It doesn't just get dry, it gets itchy and irritated. And ordinary lotions just don't seem to help.
Introducing new Gold Bond Medicated Body Lotion. Unlike the leading moisturizers, only Gold Bond Lotion has a triple action formula that replenishes your skin with three moisturizers, soothes and protects with dimethicone, and stops itch with a proven medicated itch fighter.
With Gold Bond Lotion, the dryness is gone, the itch is gone, and my skin feels refreshed.
Gold Bond Medicated Body Lotion. More than a moisturizer, it's medicated. Use only as directed.
You have good days, and you have bad days. Days when owning your own business is the best feeling in the world. And days when it feels like that very same world rests heavily on your shoulders. Days when you could use a partner. Days when you could use an advisor. At Inc.com, we know those days occur more often than you'd like, which is why we offer you advice and articles, as well as products and services that have been screened, tested, and awarded the Inc.com click of approval. Visit us and you'll see why Inc.com is known as the place to start and run your business. Don't get us wrong. We'll never claim to have all the answers. Never trust anyone who says they do. It's you who makes your business run. We just provide the tools, advice, and ideas to help you run it. Because although you own your own business, we know that sometimes it feels like your business owns you. Inc.com. You. Incorporated.
Vitamins cost too much, so I started Vitamins.com, where we guarantee the lowest price or it's free on 10 trusted brands. Click on Vitamins.com for details. Take charge of your health. See our online encyclopedia. Check drug interactions, and even create a personal health plan. And now, get $15 off your first Vitamins.com order, and shipping is always free. Vitamins.com, lowest price online, or it's free.
Now, from Radio 720 WGN Chicago, this is Extension 720. Here's your host, Milton Rosenberg.
And we will now invite telephone calls. We're opening the lines. The number, as ever, is 591-7200. We'll be on to the phones in about 10 or 12 minutes. 591-7200 is the number. And if you're listening on the internet far away over on the other side of the Rockies or on some other continent and you'd like to reach us via email, you're free to do that as well. The email address is extension720@tribune.com. extension720@tribune.com. We do, of course, tend to give some priority to messages from other countries. 591-7200. If you're in this country and if you're close by and want to call us, do so instantly. I repeat the question. What is to be done?
Well, I think the first thing we need to do is to recognize that this is indeed the legitimate province of public policy. And I think that the first problem we're facing, particularly here in the States, it's bigger here than anywhere else in the world, is a sort of libertarian hesitancy, a sort of post-consensus with the provisions and so on. But there is a treaty in place there, Council of Europe Treaty, which I think made a beginning. But the first thing is to say this is a public policy question. It's not merely a question for the market, for privatized morals, and for come what may.
Yeah, I would agree. And I would also, this is just to pick up an echo of something that we talked about before. There is a tendency in these discussions to cast these issues as an issue between the religious and the secular communities. That's a mistake. There are people of faith and people without faith who somehow recognize and will increasingly recognize, and hopefully with our help, that this is not just business as usual. This is the question of how far and how fast we go in the direction of Brave New World, and that this is an important public policy question. It does appear to be true on the basis of precedent that technology marches to its own drummer and there's nothing you can do but wring your hands and eventually submit. But our loss of infatuation with technology is fairly recent. Only recently have we begun to see the prices that we've paid for many of the things that we esteem. The SST in this country stopped. The plutonium-driven mechanical heart was stopped. There is a bill in Congress to put an end to reproductive cloning. There are two bills, in fact. That's the trouble. That's the reason might not get any. But I do think that the more people realize that some of the uses of some of these techniques are deep threats to human dignity, I think the age of technological automatism might come to an end.
How then, John Kilner, do we bring people to that degree of clarity of mind?
Well, I think that we have to look at the way that people are attempting to justify these new developments. And a common thread that we see, whether it's in terms of end-of-life decisions or stem cell research or cloning, a very common way of thinking is, well, it's a utilitarian way of thinking. I mean, it just says that if we can produce enough benefits, then anything is okay. Benefits to society, benefits to people, that sort of thing. And of course, that way of thinking says that anything can be justified as long as it'll produce benefits. And that's where we end up with the Brave New World. That's where we end up with destroying human embryos. That's where we end up with the, of course, the slave states and the Nazi Germanies. And it's a way of thinking. I think we need to challenge that if we want to protect and respect human beings. Now, of course, the core question there is, ought we to respect and protect human beings? And there we're really pushed back to core questions. I mean, on what basis need we protect human life, protect human beings? Now, certainly, there are various answers to that question. I mean, a biblical framework talks about people created in the image of God, and that's a very strong basis for respecting and protecting human life. Other people don't operate out of a religious framework, but of course, if you don't and you have a gut intuition that we need to protect and respect human life, then you have to come up with some account of that. So the challenge is, do we need to respect and protect human life? And if so, then we have to stand up against this utilitarian way of thinking and saying, you know, we cannot simply justify a practice because it's going to produce benefits. There are certain prices that are too great to pay in order to achieve benefits.
Yeah, but in your last comment, when you talk about certain prices that are too great to pay,
yeah,
that could be translated into a utilitarian argument of a much better sort. And America is a utilitarian country in part. It's not only that. I mean, there are the biblical traditions which are present at the founding and remain strong. But this is a country where what works is endorsed, and it's increasingly a pluralistic country, whether one likes it or not, and one can't simply count on the kind of consensus on the basis of a shared inherited tradition. We've got to look for new ways. So, I mean, while I join you in many of these arguments, I'm also interested in trying to take the utilitarian arguments that people make and say, look, you guys haven't really seen what the price is.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what you see is a cure for this disease or a little less suffering here or a little longer life there, but you haven't seen that what this really means is turning procreation into manufacture or a certain kind of degradation of human relations, yes, or things of that sort. And that could be what we need. What we need in addition, it seems to me, to what you would bring to such a discussion, is a richer understanding of what the real benefits and especially what the real costs are, and in fact to turn the thing around and to say, look, what are we really trying to accomplish with all of this medicine? And to try to talk about the goals in a positive way rather than being put in the position of having to oppose these new developments all the time and look like a bunch of curmudgeon-y Neanderthal characters who just want to gum up the technological works.
Do you have a properly morally sensitized set of relevant professions, medicine, the many varieties of biological science, and so on? Or have our accomplished people in those realms been trained narrowly and rewarded merely for technical accomplishment and for lots of publication and the usual kind of career path, so that, in fact, they lacked any kind of system, any grounding in moral concerns which can be systematically activated to examine the issues as one goes forward in this kind of work?
Yeah, I think you raise some, of course, a series of very interesting questions there, Milt. I think the professions have largely been eviscerated of the kind of moral vision which gave coherence to the professional tradition. But that itself is a subset of a broader problem which we really have only sort of hinted at in our discussion so far. I mean, the bioethics question, the biotech question, which raises part of the bioethics agenda than all of it. I mean, these are within the context of a culture which is in crisis, which is in revolution. You can use various terms for this, in which we're moving out of what I think Christopher Dawson, the Catholic historian, used to define as a secularized Christendom, which was his, I think, useful sort of periodization of the post-Enlightenment period in the West. I think you only understand it if you see it as Christendom, but it's secularized into something else. And this post-Christian, post-Judeo-Christian, post-whatever context in which we find ourselves today is one in which we no longer have settled values as a community. We no longer have much interest in discovering settled values, which is really very new. It isn't that we disagree about what's true. Truth is something, values are something which it would privatized. And so we don't have a framework within which we can cope with radically new opportunities.
Furthermore, we have an intellectual movement which dominates in some sectors of the American university and in many of the Western European universities as well, which defines itself as specializing in the arts and the joy of transgression, breaking up normative systems, whatever they may be, mm-hmm. and épaté les bourgeois and épaté everybody else, and in essence achieve full freedom at last by getting beyond the bounds of any agreed system of moral constraints.
Yes, and that, of course, sort of has an echo on the ground where we have, you know, kids going up to college and experimenting sexually and so on and seeking to make for themselves a moral universe all of their own because they haven't grown up in one which they have any part. And there are all sorts of intellectual resonances with that kind of experience. And I don't think it's a chicken or eggs. I mean, there are a lot of factors which have led to this breakup of the Western consensus at every level. But into this situation, you provide extraordinary new possibilities. I mean, the biotech thing drives itself. There's an exponential kind of development in possibilities here. And we get back to the point that was being made by Leon Cass about the problem of utility. I mean, both the appeal and the lack of appeal of utilitarian approach to things is it short? The short-term benefit tends to be focused. I mean, the long-term entailments, even on a purely utilitarian calculus, may be shown, and I think in every one of these cases, to be supremely disadvantageous. But the lack of interest in long-term entailments, the interest in the here and now,
in quick
the immediate quick payoff, is almost exclusive, and therefore, and this really is the problem with taking a utilitarian kind of approach here. I think you haven't got to import some sort of principles from deontology or anywhere else to show that this thing will shipwreck the project of human dignity in the Western tradition. But you've got to be able to press the argument for much longer into the evening than most people have better listen.
This really suggests, to evoke an old phrase that has different connotations, that we need moral rearmament in the society generally. Mm. We need moral renewal. However we come by it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, at least the two of you, I should think that we come by it by deepening and strengthening our bonds
to historic Christianity.
Well, certainly what is attractive about, I think the challenge for any person, I mean for any human being, is first of all to take a look at this utilitarian reasoning, take a look at this experimentation, take a look at this abandonment of any notion of truth or standards, see how it plays out humanly. And of course, as we see, we're getting more and more evidence about how this plays out in people's lives, to see the destructiveness both on an individual level and on a social culture level, and then to come to the recognition that there really is a need for some basis for respecting human dignity. And so then we're forced to raise the question, well, what basis would there be? And I must say that if we're living in a universe where our only conviction is that everything is a matter of chance, of molecules that have randomly come together and somehow we've just ended up with human life and whatever, then there's not a really very satisfactory basis for necessarily respecting and protecting human life. I think that's the attraction of the account that we find in the biblical writings of people created in the image of God. It helps to explain our sense of the significance, the uniqueness of human life and human beings, gives us an account of our sense that there is a standard, a norm beyond ourselves. I think that's part of the attractiveness, but I think the challenge is for anybody to investigate the alternatives that are available, and if they don't have an alternative, then of course the
I would like to insist that you can come to the same judgments and the same kinds of concerns and the same application of those concerns mm-hmm. on a secular basis.
I would agree, though I would have to say that I culturally speaking, I think my colleagues here are right. I think individuals can come to these conclusions on the basis of thoughtfulness and so on. But as a matter of culture, we're in the midst of a real experiment to see whether what the ancients used to say is true. No gods, no city. We're going to find out whether it's possible for our culture to survive insofar as it becomes progressively non-theistic or atheistic. But I was going to say, Milt, just like you, I taught Darwin's Origin of the Species for the first time well after my scientific and medical training. And it was the most strange thing. It was like a religious experience for me. I came to the end of that book and I said the following to myself: if Darwin is right, and I happen in fact to think that he's right, that there should be Darwin, and that I should be here reading him, is miraculous. That is to say, that's a very special kind of soup out of which all.
If there's a Darwin, there must be a God, which we're
well, or some that there's more here, that there are powers here and mysteries that mm-hmm. we don't understand that are far greater than our science teaches. Mm-hmm. So I think one could come to the respect for life and human dignity, even forgive me if our ancestors were monkeys. It's quite a remarkable thing, for good and bad, the kind of creatures that we
very
are.
Very nicely said. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gentlemen, we must pause yet once again, and we will go to the phones directly after these impending commercials. And so, there are a few lines available, and a number of lines are taken. If you want to join in the conversation, move quickly and call us instantly on 591-7200. 591-7200. If you're listening from far away and want to reach us via email, the email address, extension720@tribune.com. extension720@tribune.com. And we return directly after these words.
This man is obsessed.
Yeah.
He loves the luster of an intense winter storm.
That could be interesting.
His name?
Tom Peterson.
Tom Peterson. WGN Radio News Director and Vice President of School Closing.
Is there a big storm brewing on the West Coast that might be heading our way?
When you're a boy who cut his teeth north of the Cheddar Curtain, life isn't interesting until the precipitation freezes. No cause for alarm.
Keep an eye out.
When winter finally arrives, hey there, Peterson and his troops will be here for you.
I'm Tom Peterson on Chicago's News and Talk Radio 720 WGN.
What a concept. A sale on shoes that actually fit. AA to EE shoes knows how to fit your hard-to-fit feet. And this month, every second pair of shoes is 40% off. Call 847-398-5000 and visit the store that stocks 35,000 pairs in women's sizes ranging from 4 to 14 and men's sizes 5 to 20 and all the right widths from AA to 5Es. They understand doctor-diagnosed foot problems like heel spurs, bunions, neuromas, and plantar fasciitis, and truly care about the diabetic foot or anyone needing truly comfortable shoes. AA to EE shoes features the most trusted brands like SAS, New Balance, Rockport, Echo, PW Minor, Extra Depth Shoes, Soft Spots, and much more. So stop hurting and walk into AA to EE shoes this month and receive 40% off each second pair. Call 847-398-5000 or visit them at 2837 Kirchhoff Road, 1 mile east of Route 53 in Rolling Meadows. Some restrictions apply. You know smoking can damage your health. You'd like to quit. You've even tried before, but eventually had that irresistible urge to light up. It's not easy to kick the smoking habit, but there is hope and help. If you're a smoker who's ready to quit, but you need help to control your urge to smoke, you're invited to enroll in a program developed by researchers from the University of Illinois at Chicago and Hines VA Medical Center. They're offering smoking cessation research programs aimed at helping you manage the stress that often undermines your attempts to quit. You can get the support you need to give up smoking, and best of all, here's the surprise. This program is absolutely free. If you'd like to find out more about Chicagoland Quit Smoking, call 312-355-2153. Call right now and take the next step toward a healthier life. To enroll today in downtown Chicago or the western suburbs, call Chicagoland Quit Smoking at 312-355-2153.
From Radio 720 WGN, this is Extension 720. Here's your host, Milt Rosenberg.
And in our discussion of bioethics, we will go directly to the phones after I quickly reintroduce our guests. They have been and continue to be Leon Kass, professor in the college and in the Committee on Social Thought at the University of Chicago, John Kilner, director of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity in Bannockburn, Illinois, and professor of bioethics and contemporary culture at Trinity International University in Deerfield, and Nigel Cameron, who is the chairman of the advisory board of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity and is the former provost at Trinity International University. 591-7200 is the number, and here, gentlemen, is the first caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. A fascinating and unfortunately frightening show. I guess at the basic level, everyone on the panel tonight agrees about the importance of the fundamental human dignity and you know, how careful we need to be. And I think there's unanimity, in fact, in terms of the direction that we need to go in terms of technology and biotechnology. And if I had to, it's comforting to me to hear that unanimity, but unfortunately I would think that among bioethicists in general, there is not this degree of unanimity. One gentleman particularly comes to mind, the gentleman at Princeton, I believe he's still on the faculty there, whose views I would say are repugnant, but...
You mean the philosopher Singer?
No, the bioethicist at Princeton University, and his name is escaping me right now, but his appointment has been very controversial.
Peter Singer?
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
Exactly. And I'm just wondering, given the importance that bioethicists are going to play in terms of shaping public opinion and really provoking and asking the tough questions in this area and forcing us to think about this, how would you assess are there more gentlemen like Peter Singer out there who are of the view that, human life is not that precious, and if you kill a child, not in the womb, but after it's been born, hey, that's okay. Or is there any kind of consensus on this? Or if we sample bioethicists more broadly, are we going to see some of those what I consider very repugnant views be much more in the mainstream?
The fashion in the great universities these days is to make major appointments from the radical fringe in a way that will sort of excite the press, please the historic younger professors, and in general, stir up excitement. We see that in many universities, I think, including the University of Chicago.
And Singer is certainly such an appointment at Princeton.
I think that's certainly true. I mean, Peter Singer, I think, serves a very useful function because he says things that many other people in bioethics think. He gives voice to tendencies in an extreme way. He's at one end of the spectrum. But he's respected and as a leader within the bioethics community, and I think, therefore, he is much more significant than many of those who would like to distance themselves from him.
Well, let me understand that. Which judgments of Singer's do you think most bioethicists would confess to sharing, if only over a beer?
I think that his essential repudiation of the Western tradition, of the Judeo-Christian tradition, I mean, mm-hmm. his notion that basically the Christians were wrong to save, to try and save the babies and you know, give dignity to human life and so on, this was actually a mistake on the part of the Western tradition, that most cultures abandon their elderly and so should we, in a more sophisticated way, but that's the point he's making. I think these positions are tacitly held by many people who wouldn't give them voice.
Well, it may be that lots of philosophers or just general intellectuals would agree, but I'm a little disturbed to hear you say that most bioethicists.
Well, I tell you, the bioethics community, so-called, is in fact, ideologically, a pretty extreme group of people. I mean, they have a great deal in common with each other. I mean, there are those of us who participate in these discussions who are on the other end of the spectrum, but the center of gravity of bioethics as a discussion is in a pretty radical philosophical kind of position, which cuts itself off from the Western tradition and seeks to redo all that. I mean, read a bioethics book, try and find a reference at the back of the book before about 1975, 1980. It's a difficult thing to do. This whole discipline is reinventing itself.
Well, I don't quite agree. And I mean, I have my great differences with the mainstream in bioethics, and I'm closer to my two colleagues here than to the mainstream. And that's partly because I believe that you cut off your nose to spite your face if you ignore the insights of the great religious traditions that have been around for a long time and will be around a lot longer than bioethics, because they have seen to the bottom of our condition with the kind of gravity that this subject deserves and that many people don't bring to bioethics. I think Peter Singer's extreme views are probably not that widely shared. And I would say what worries me in the conventional, now routinized profession of bioethics is that the notion of autonomy, and a very shallow one at that, has trumped absolutely everything else. Autonomy, to some extent, the questions of distributive justice, of scarce resources, some kind of legal regulation around the margins so that you can do all kinds of horrible things, provided you've talked about it first and pronounced the kind of bioethical blessing on it. Bioethics was a field that got started because people like the three of us were worried about the questions of human nature and human dignity in the face of these new challenges. Nobody who started the field of bioethics was trained in bioethics. Paul Ramsey, a great Protestant theologian, Hans Jonas, a great European philosopher, Dobzhansky, a great geneticist. These people were worried about what this meant for our humanity. The field has gotten shrunk because so much of it has been handled through the law. Questions of rights and autonomy and freedom have trumped everything else, and no one really worries about what the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity is been erected to confront. So, I mean, I wish my two colleagues all my blessings, because they really have taken this question on at its heart. So the problem is deep, but I don't think it's the extreme case of being in favor of infanticide or bumping off the old. It's a rather shallow indifference to the real gravity of what's before us, of which that's, I think, just the tip of the iceberg. Now, I may be wrong.
Just add a footnote. I mean, I think my concern about Singer is that he is deeply respected within the bioethics community. Now, I mean, I have met him once or twice personally. I'm not saying anything against him as an individual. But the fact that despite the fact he holds these views, I mean, he has presided over this International Association for Bioethics, which he founded. He is not regarded as
a pariah.
As a pariah.
Yeah,
in the way in which, if the community were a healthy community, surely he would be.
Yeah, well, that's fair.
What's symptomatic about that is it's not so much his views espousing or legitimizing infanticide that are widely shared or widely advocated, but it is that that rejection of any fundamental notion of human dignity. I mean, it's very much what you were referring to before.
But look, I mean, let me try to say something on the other side. The autonomy argument, which has carried the day,
define, if you would, the autonomy.
The argument that each of us is master in our own house and ought to have ultimate authority over what's done with our bodies, with our lives, with our deaths, and everything. That each of us is a law unto himself. That's a corruption of a doctrine developed in the West by Kant,
mm-hmm.
And it has real philosophical power, and in fact was thought, and is thought by some of these people, to be of the essence of human dignity. What is human dignity if not the exercise of your own freedom without any constraints? Now, that's, I think, the way it's now been developed. It means do whatever you damn please without any kind of sober submission to what's rational or what's universalizable. But they would claim that they're the real defenders of human dignity against certain kinds of shrunken notions. I don't agree with them, mm-hmm. but it's not that they're anti-Western.
A practical question on the part of our listeners. If any of the listeners wanted to go deeper into this new realm of bioethics, which has been a kind of shared concern between philosophers and people in the biological and medical professions only in the last few decades, where would they look? Is there a reader? Is there some particular book that would be worth recommending?
It's always a question when you ask for a recommendation. Is this where you're going to find out what people are thinking and doing, or is this where you'd send somebody to get wisdom?
Mm. Well, let's have one of each.
Well, if you want to find out what the field looks like, read the Hastings Center report.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the oldest institutes. If you want to look for wisdom in these matters, read the writing of Hans Jonas, J-O-N-A-S. Read the writings of Paul Ramsey. My colleagues here will have other candidates.
Leon Kass.
Leon Kass, yes.
As a source, again, as opposed to identifying specific information, another question is, you know, where would you go to find out if you're interested in pursuing these matters further? And I will just say, as a practical matter, that one of the reasons that the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity exists is as a resource to people who want to pursue these matters further. And
I think you are required then to give the phone number and the email address.
Yes, well,
right,
it is
the web address.
Yes, well, the web is www.cbhd, which is just the initials for the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity, cbhd.org, so www.cbhd.org. The phone number, which is in the 847 area code, is 317-8180. And again, people are on hand to deal with specific issues and needs, as well as to refer people to resources in the field.
With that, let us pause for the usual reasons and then right back to the phones. Some lines available again if you've been trying to reach us. We've cleared one or two lines, so do try again. 591-7200, the number, 591-7200.
When the outside temperature drops below 20 degrees, water pipes in homes with little or no insulation can freeze and break. State Farm Insurance wants to help you avoid damage to your home and possessions caused by frozen pipes. Be sure to insulate pipes that are most likely to freeze in cold weather, those in outer walls and attics or in crawl spaces. Let your faucets trickle overnight in sinks located in outside walls and leave cabinet doors open under those sinks. If you're going away for an extended period of time, maintain adequate heat in your home by setting the thermostat no lower than 55 degrees. This message brought to you by the good neighbors at State Farm Insurance. Watch CLTV's Good Eating this week as they take a crack at eggs. Local chefs talk about the many ways to use eggs in everything from Caesar's salad dressing to creme brulee. Then get tips on making delicious French and American omelets. Also learn how to prepare a mouth-watering bread pudding using eggs, of course. To round out this week's show, they talk with California winemakers to see what they're predicting for the next few years. Be sure to watch CLTV's Good Eating. It's the cable TV companion to the Chicago Tribune's Good Eating food section. And remember, it's all about good eating Saturdays at 10 a.m. and again at 5 p.m. only on CLTV, only on cable.
Hey, Reeves.
Boss, could you explain this memo I just got?
Yes. A memo is a time-tested business method of communication between management and staff.
No, I mean, what's this about no black socks with Bermuda shorts?
I'm standing firm on that point.
But I thought the dress code didn't allow Bermuda shorts at all.
Well, apparently nobody told Carl.
Carl?
Oh, actually, Carl's here on vacation.
And what, he's hoping to get a tan from the copy machine?
No, Carl's just demonstrating how much he loves working at Walla Walla.
He's demonstrating with those legs?
No, see, since we hired Administaff, a lot of the employees are taking their vacation right here at the office.
You're kidding.
Look, everybody's grateful that Administaff offers us better health benefits, a retirement plan, a credit union.
Uh-huh.
Plus, Administaff gives us big advantages through their relationship with companies like American Express. It all makes Walla Walla a nice place to be.
Well, that's great. Tell everyone to forget the memo. What in the world?
Oh, yeah, that's Bobby. On his vacation, he works on his car.
Make your company a better place to work. Administaff can show you how. Call 1-800-465-3800. Administaff. We take care of your people so you can take care of your business.
We now return to Extension 720 from WGN Radio Chicago. Now, here's Milton Rosenberg.
And before we go back to the phones, a quick announcement or two concerning this program. As I've been telling you lately, we are expanding our audio file. If you are equipped with a sound card and have access to real audio on the Internet, then you will find on our website a vast amount of programming representing the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s. Excerpts from various programs, and now we've begun to put on full two-hour programs. There were a few there for the last few months, but now we've adopted a new policy, and every week we are putting up two programs from the prior week that we thought worthy of maintenance and continued existence. And so we've done that with the programs from last week. I'll tell you which programs they are next time around. But I do also want to remind you that as part of our general technologization, we have now given up our mailed program guide list, and instead we are sending it out by email, and over 1,000 people have subscribed, and we have room for an infinite number. You pay $10 to get it by mail. You get it free on email. All you need to do is email us and say, please put me on the list. You can even say, put me on the list without the please, and you will be put on the list. The address, of course, the web address is... The email address, I should say, I'm still getting used to this vocabulary myself, is extension720@tribune.com. extension720@tribune.com. If you get in there quickly, we will still, I think, have time to send you the January list, which has gone out to all who are already subscribed. And with that, quickly, back to the phones. You are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. If you took a child cloned from Madonna and sent her to a remote section of Lapland for adoption by a loving couple who respected the child's individuality, and the child were unaware that she had perhaps a number of doppelgangers around the planet, I don't think there would be any problem. So it is the desire to control the child which is the source of the potential evil. And this desire to control the child and to control other human beings has been going on for a few thousand years now. Why else did the prophets preach? The desire for autonomy is a logical consequence of a market culture that throws people, particularly children, away. I just heard earlier tonight on some radio program, maybe it was in this discussion, the percentage of births out of wedlock in 1950 in the United States was one half of 1% of all childbirths, and it is now 30%. Well, this has anteceded even the abortion movement. It is a manifestation of people who are lost in a culture that is already disrespectful of individuality because it is a market culture.
So you're suggesting treat them well and their genetic composition doesn't matter particularly.
No, I think that if I understand the questioner, I think you're onto something really important. The technology may accelerate certain kinds of things and may even clarify what's been going on in other respects.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that in some very deep way, this is an despite all the appearances to the contrary, this is an anti-natalist, anti-child culture increasingly. And abortion is only a small part of what's here. It's a culture in which adults seek their own fulfillment first and find some ways to persuade themselves that the children are better off.
There is an important book by Kay Heimowitz, who will be our guest on this program in a few weeks, in which he argues that essentially we have abandoned our children even within family.
Oh, I think that's, I'm glad you're having her on. It's a wonderful book.
Yeah, I agree it is. I must read you an email that I've got here. I often recount for my students a story about a professor at Berkeley who told his students about a woman with tuberculosis and a husband with syphilis. Their first child was born blind, the second was deaf, and the third was born dead. Their fourth child was born with TB, and now the mother was pregnant again. What would you advise these parents to do? The professor asked his class. Without hesitation, the students all advised abortion. You have just murdered Ludwig von Beethoven, responded the professor. I didn't know those biographical facts
it's
about
true.
Beethoven.
Yeah, this is a story I think all three of us have probably... Yeah.
I know it was an unfortunate family. I didn't know all of that detail.
Yeah.
591-7200, as we go back to the phones. Good evening, you're on the air. Hello, are you there?
Yes.
Go ahead, sir.
I want to know what your panelists think about the characteristics of human dignity. In other words, when we see extreme poverty, some say they have lost human dignity. So if we say we lose our minds or we lose our health, do we then lose our human dignity? Or is human dignity even further deeper than that? That the very fact that we are human, we are dignified to some degree. So I'd like to hear your panelists' opinion or thinking on this issue.
Valuable question. John Kilmer.
Yes, I think that that's a very good insight. I think that human dignity goes much deeper than mere circumstances or attributes. That's fundamentally the problem with the discussions of many of the issues, where we say, well, we have respect for human beings, but if they lose these characteristics toward the end of life, or if they are born or projected to be born absent certain abilities, or born into certain social circumstances of impoverishment, then they lack what is important for a human being to have, so therefore we can dispense with them. Human dignity is a much deeper thing that is not a function of mere environment or particular functional capacities, but is something that is a characteristic of being human itself.
How would you define it?
Well, I mean, I think there are different ways that one can approach this, but I mean, from my own point of view, that the key question here is understanding what it means to be a human being. And as a Christian, I mean, I would take the view this means to be made in the image of God, which carries simply an infinite weight of dignity, and which ensures that whether you're an embryo, or whether you're in a persistent vegetative state, or whether you're rich or poor, or whatever your ethnicity and religion and so on, that you have a dignity which is essentially the dignity of God imparted in time and space. And this lends a significance specifically to those who are weaker, those who are on the margins of the human race, those who are not those who can think and argue and have power and so on, which is disproportionately great. Whereas, of course, so many of the tendencies in the contemporary cultural situation in bioethics devalue their dignity. And it is this which I think has led religious people, I mean, not simply Christians, but Jews and Muslims and Hindus and others, to take the lead in showing their revulsion against the direction of much of the secular thinking in bioethics, which essentially regards human dignity as something which is quantifiable and ultimately to be determined by the kind of functional capacities of the individual.
Mm. Well, I'm not so sure I would simply, I mean, if one has to do this without the benefit of the language of image of God, which, by the way, is a language I like, if one wants to speak to people who are, who would not understand human dignity in those terms, I think one could begin to speak about, powers and possibilities and, opportunities and responsibilities and relations we have by virtue of our humanity, attachments, love, the moral life, the opportunity to ponder our place in this great cosmos that the other animals inhabit with us, but presumably do not ponder. These are not exactly functions in a kind of narrow utilitarian sense, but they are manifestations of our special standing, which give us special obligations and make us stand here, it seems to me, not as claimants trying to work out the most advantageous thing for ourselves, but to justify the gift of being here, whether or not there was a giver or not. I mean, that we have a gift of life here, which is a very peculiar kind of thing in this world. And to reflect on it is to know our difference, and to live that life without respecting that difference and the powers we have is, in fact, to degrade ourselves even voluntarily.
We thank you, sir. A very valuable question. And once again, and for the last time around, a brief pause for some commercial messages, and then back to your calls on 591-7200.
The Northwestern Wildcats get back to Big Ten play Thursday night when the Penn State Nittany Lions visit Welsh Ryan Arena.
Your cat, the Hartwood, your radio, 720.
Hi, everybody. I'm Dave Ennis. Join Joey Meyer and me for the pregame show Thursday at 5:45. Tip-off live at 6 here on Chicago's News and Talk, Radio 720 WGN.
Earthquakes, tornadoes, you can't predict. The best you can do is get there fast and with as much help as possible.
Jackie Johnson is a member of the Allstate National Catastrophe Team. She goes to places people are usually trying to leave.
We don't go there just to deliver checks. Some people think that's the whole point. Well, it really isn't. Getting checks to people who need them is important, but being there for people who have no one else to turn to, now that brings some hope. Sometimes that's worth more than just a check.
You can buy insurance from people who just sell it over the phone. You might save a dollar. But if bad things happen, will there be a Jackie Johnson there for you and others like her to take your claim 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? Lots of companies sell insurance, but no one has people like Allstate.
You're in good hands with Allstate. Mine.
Allstate Insurance Company, Northbrook, Illinois, and on the web at allstate.com.
The Harris Bank has your best interest at heart. For a limited time, the Harris is offering the CD of the Century, a 14-month certificate of deposit paying a 6.2% annual percentage yield. The Harris rate is much higher than the rate that many banks are paying on 2- and 3-year CDs. So if you'd like to earn a 6.2% APY without tying up your money for 2 or 3 years, the Harris 14-month CD may be exactly what you need. And your funds are safe because they're FDIC insured. Minimum deposit is $10,000. This offer ends soon, so stop by any of the Harris Chicagoland locations now or call 1-800-LION-101 for more information. That's 1-800-546-6101. Harris Bank, helping you make better choices. Interest is compounded daily. This offer may be withdrawn at any time without notice. Good for personal accounts only and does not apply to individual retirement accounts.
While everyone is celebrating the new year, Goods Furniture has entered their third century. Yes, Goods has been providing the finest furniture over a span of 3 centuries at the same location in Kewaunee, Illinois. Way back then, folks came by horse and buggy over dirt roads. The sidewalks were made of wood, and Grandpa Goods' little store was lit by kerosene lamps. Who would have believed what Goods has become today? There are 9 multi-story buildings, skywalks, glass elevators, even a wine cellar restaurant, and bed and breakfast. But the real attraction remains the same. You always get the very best price on name brand furniture, and you get that great low price every day. No gimmicks, no haggling over price, no waiting for sales. You get the lowest price on the furniture you want when you want it. And yes, Goods delivers to Chicagoland. Make the easy trip to Kewaunee just off Interstate 80 and help Goods celebrate the beginning of their third century. They're open every day from 9 till 6. For information, call 309-852-5656 or visit their all-new website at goodsfurniture.com.
We now return to Extension 720 from WGN Radio Chicago. This is Milton Rosenberg.
And as promised a few minutes ago, here's a quick rundown on the full 2-hour programs that we've placed on our audio file at the Extension 720 site within
the WGN radio site, which is, if you want to reach it, simply WGNradio.com. Last week, we did a program with three members of the National Linguistics Organization when they were meeting in Chicago, and that's on the site. Fascinating discussion, I thought that to be. And on January 3rd, we talked with three, count them, three television critics who turned out to be surprisingly fond of television. They didn't join fully in reinforcing my own curmudgeonly distaste for the medium. But still, we had an interesting conversation indeed. The previous week, we did two programs that we've also now got up on the archive for you to listen to again or to direct others to if you choose. We did a program reviewing the year 1999. That is clips from Extension 720 over 1999. And we also did our end of the year review with Georgie Ann Geyer, Mike McGuire, and Robert Schmuel of Notre Dame. I thought an excellent discussion of how history was made last year. With that, we go quickly back to the phones, and you are next on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. I just want to pose a question. Last month, when Veterans Day, I visited the parents of a boy who died in Vietnam in 67. If they had been able to clone him and bring him back as a baby, he'd be 33 now. And the same goes for somebody, let's say they have a two-year-old boy who runs in the street and gets killed, and I just want the bioethical debate on that. Should that be allowed since it's now possible?
That's a very interesting question and a very particularized one.
I do think the answer is no, and I think it's important to recognize why it's no, why intuitively most of us would be very unhappy with this, because whereas this might indeed minister to the grief of the parents, there's no question. This is not a decision that would be taken in the interest of the new child, who would grow up in the shadow of somebody else, a copy of somebody else, fulfilling other people's expectations. I think a child who will grow up in counseling. And the problem with so many of these reproductive issues is the child's interests are not paramount, and they surely need to be.
Interesting.
Mm. Well, my colleagues are nodding, but they're not yeah. joining in the conversation.
I think that was wonderfully said. I think one could also say, nothing I would say should suggest that I do anything but sympathize deeply with this loss. But it does seem to me the way that people deal with loss is, in fact, to grieve. And rather than try to replace that loss in this kind of artificial and, as Nigel said, potentially dangerous to the child way, it's very painful, but we have to somehow struggle with it and not try to make it good in this kind of artificial and potentially harmful way.
Here's something else related to cloning, an email. If you combine advances in cloning with advances in brain surgery, might it not lead to the possibility of immortality for the super-rich person? That is, if we define person as a continuity of consciousness and memory. Death would no longer be the great equalizer.
Well, I think there are a couple of issues that are bound into that. One is the whole question of the quest for immortality, which we could talk some about. But another interesting question that very much relates to these emerging genetic technologies and cloning technologies is the notion of these being especially accessible to the rich. I think that there's an economic and a distributive justice issue here that we really haven't touched on too much tonight. But it is the question that as we develop these new capabilities, who will have access to these capabilities? Because it's the one thing to say we're creating the possibility of great new benefits and benefits that will help people to have greater abilities, greater capacities, which again we can celebrate from a human perspective. But if they have the effect of giving certain people or certain groups of people radical benefit or even control or power over other people, I think that we need to view the way these technologies are allowed to develop from a social perspective and not just from a purely individual libertarian perspective, because they create the differences that we've had among people in terms of wealth will pale by comparison to the differences that will result technologically.
Here's a theme that I sounded earlier, but it resonates in this contribution.
And I think it's worth turning to a little bit more completely. Your guests seem to rely largely on religious arguments, or at least phraseology, to support their positions. Where does this leave those who are not religious?
Well, brief response. I mean, this is an enormous question. I think really my own mind moves on to parallel tracks, plainly because of my own religion, and most people in this country are religious of one kind or another. We plainly have a religious approach. At the same time, this doesn't mean to say that we're disconnected from a public conversation, in that all of these matters can be considered on their own merits. And it seems to me cloning is a good example of this. I think you wouldn't have to be religious to see the fundamental problematic of introducing cloned human beings and the significance of this for their dignity and so on and so forth, without ever getting into a religious conversation. And I think we each need to be true to our own tradition and our own worldview here, which for most of us in North America is religious, typically Christian, some Jewish, some Islamic, and so on. At the same time, we have to have a realm of public discourse in which we can come together and have this conversation.
In fact, Leon Kass is a close student of Judaism, closer than I am, surely. How do you connect what you find in the Jewish tradition and in Jewish scripture to the matters that we've been discussing?
Well, it's very complicated, I mean, I should say that almost all of my public writings in bioethics, I've tried to argue on the plane of what I take to be my own basic human and or thoughtful, my human intuitions and my thoughtful reflections.
You have not written as a religious, then? I have not,
though I wouldn't be surprised if to discover that my Jewish origins and increasingly my Jewish interests are somehow present. I'm probably parasitic on a tradition that's my grandparents abandoned and that I'm trying to recover. But the Jewish tradition on some of these things is embarrassing to me, especially because of the wonderful emphasis on life. When I testified before the National Bioethics Advisory Commission in opposition to cloning, as a, quote, ethicist, the Jewish delegates there were in favor of it because if it produces new babies that are healthy, who could be against it? And the argument from nature or that this is unnatural or something like that, that's a Catholic argument, and that doesn't cut any ice with them. So the Jewish, Catholic, and Protestant traditions are not on all fours on all of these questions, and I still think we ought to be looking for a kind of common ground on the with a kind of deeper understanding of what actually is our humanity, a question that comes to the fore and which anybody has an access to. There can't be, and this is my article of faith, whatever our differences, there can't be more than one wisdom on this subject. We all have a piece of it, and the question is to carry on the dialogue until we somehow come to its bottom.
I get a sense that so much was captured then and is still captured by Schweitzer's famous phrase, reverence for life. Mm. It seems to me that one could subsume much of what you're arguing, or derive it from, the maintenance of a reverence for life as different circumstances in terms of scientific developments offer yet new enigmas.
Very much so, and something that is grounded, immediately speaking, just on our experience of life, our experience of human beings relationally, what we know about the science and as genetics unpacks the wonders of human existence. I mean, it's very much there on a plane that's accessible to all people. And so what a religious understanding, what a biblical understanding does is it gives an account that goes beyond what we observe. But I think that what we're saying is not something contrary to that. It's still something that's accessible very much on a human level. So this is a public discussion. It's a human discussion.
Yeah. Can I just add a point? I mean, I think the significance of the Hippocratic tradition, I think, is a good example here of how this can operate. Because Hippocrates, of course, was a pre-Christian pagan. There's much debate about his own religious philosophical position, but he was in particular position among the many Greek philosophical schools. And his vision, which is encapsulated in the oath which bears his name, and which has become the foundation stone for Western medicine, very influential in Islamic medicine as well as Jewish and Christian medical traditions, it's nominally pagan. And yet the Hippocratic Oath, or some version of it, is still affirmed or sworn in the great majority of medical schools in North America.
and it offers common ground for our conversation about human values in medicine.
I must share this with you, something that was emailed in touches on a scientific projection in relation to something that you suggested earlier, Nigel. I think that the idea that if you had a herd of 1,500 cloned cows or sheep, all with the same immune system, those clever little bacteria, viruses, and protozoa will quickly take care of the problem. Widespread cloning among humans is not only a profit-driven CEO's fondest dream, but also that of an antibiotic-resistant TB bacillus.
I'm happy to believe that is part of the depressing truth of our situation.
Uh-huh. One of the things, actually, this comment enables me to say, I mean, the three of us take these new developments very seriously and try not to underestimate their import. But I think one should also not simply blindly accept the scientists' naively optimistic projection about all the things that they can do and the things that they can do without will be without their own biological consequences. This last question, I think, makes the point very powerfully.
Mm-hmm.
We should keep a skeptical eye and make sure that they know what they're talking about and that their promises are not overblown, even as we worry about the implications of what if they're right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There are self-correcting mechanisms, but I think one we've got to remember is the experience of thalidomide in the 60s in Europe, where, of course, a whole generation of kids were born limbless before it was realized this drug shouldn't be used in pregnancy. And we look back and say, how could that have happened? And I think we will have those sort of experiences as we correct ourselves, and it'll mm-hmm. be tragic, even if we get there in the end.
Mm-hmm. And with that, gentlemen, I fear the time has elapsed. It's been a great pleasure, and I think it's been an excellent conversation. I thank you for it. Our guests have been Leon Kass, professor in the Committee on Social Thought at the University of Chicago, John Kilner, who is the director of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity, as well as professor of bioethics at Trinity International University in Deerfield, and Nigel Cameron, who was for some years the provost at Trinity International University and is the chairman of the advisory board for the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity. Once again, quickly, if we might, John, the website for the center is?
Yes, it's www.cbhd, for the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity, the acronym cbhd.org. And there's information there on many resources available.
And a quick word about tomorrow. The author of a new biography of Elijah Muhammad, Carl Evans, will be with us, as will the son of Elijah Muhammad, Imam Wallace Dean Muhammad, as we discuss the heritage of his father. That's coming up tomorrow at 9. Until then, a cordial good night to all.
Chicago's News and Talk, Radio 720 WGN Chicago, a Tribune Broadcasting station.
Here's the latest from ABC News. I'm Rich Johnson. A busy day for President Clinton means lots of money for some Texas congressional candidates. ABC's Pam Coulter is with the president in Houston.
The president started his day communing with nature at the Grand Canyon and ended it rubbing elbows with well-to-do Democratic Party donors, including Goldie Hawn in Houston. At two fundraisers, he optimistically predicted Democrats would recapture the House.